Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, recapping the final week of August 2018 with Chris Vance, former Washington State Republican Party chair. Erica C. Barnett covers the news at thecisforcrank.com. Crosscut reporter David Croman, welcome to all of you.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is anyone having end of the season affective disorder? You doing okay?
It's the start of the season.
Yeah, it's going to be sunny in September,
No.
Right?
It's the start of the season. College football starts tomorrow. Go Dogs. Best time of the year.
Best time of the year is, it's like, thank God it's Friday, is all anticipatory. It's like, what you really mean is you can't wait for Friday to be done. So are you saying the best time of year is when the Dogs haven't screwed up yet?
They don't screw up much lately, okay. Chris Peterson.
But they're going to be good this year.
They're going to be very good.
And David, you just got here from the office of Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin. Erica, you also know about the breaking news that we can't reveal yet, right?
12:30. Stay tuned.
At 12:30, we can talk about it.
Not allowed to say what it is about.
I don't know.
I'm just making it up right now. Well,
At 12:30, we can say what.
Okay, at 12:30. So let's get into some of the other news of the week. This morning, as Republican Senator John McCain lay in state at the U.S. Capitol, Vice President Mike Pence told Congress that President Trump respected McCain's service. Why didn't Trump say it himself? Because McCain asked that Trump not be at the Capitol service. Do you guys think that's part of the reason that the media are covering the McCain memorial so closely, is the news value of McCain scolding Trump from beyond the grave?
Absolutely. And I think it's kind of disconcerting when you read the coverage. I read the New York Times obituary, and honestly, I think I was five paragraphs in, and then there were 10 paragraphs that were just about Trump.
Yeah.
And I think that must be a little frustrating in some ways for people who want to memorialize McCain's legacy, which was obviously extended back far before Trump was in office and before this whole feud with Trump. But on the other hand, he also curated his own funeral to sort of give the finger to Trump in a lot of different ways. So in a way, you know, he was kind of anticipating that.
John McCain was a great United States senator, presidential nominee. He probably would be lying in state in the Capitol anyway. But absolutely, I mean, and people should just accept this. The election of Donald Trump is one of the great historical events in American history. It is one of the great turning points in our political system. We've literally never elected anyone like Donald Trump. No major democracy has. And people just need to accept that Donald Trump is the news. He is politics. He is everything. And everything that happens is in reflection or reaction to him.
But he doesn't get to speak at the McCain service because McCain asked former Presidents Bush and Obama to speak. They're going to deliver eulogies tomorrow at the service at the National Cathedral in D.C. But Trump won't be there. Sarah Palin not invited to the funeral service, apparently.
I was going to say, Chris, you probably understand better than anybody what it can happen when a Republican, the attention that a Republican can get for coming out against Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, you have a choice. You can be for Trump or you can leave the Republican Party. Or you can be silent.
In case listeners don't know, you've chosen to leave the Republican Party.
Absolutely.
I think that and perhaps we'll talk about this when we talk about Councilmember Shamasawant's rather inflammatory tweets about McCain. But I think that the idea that he was anti-Trump while that's absolutely true, he was against Trump the person. He also voted for Trump's policies pretty consistently. And so I think we can't forget that he voted for the Trump tax cuts. He voted for Trump's judges. He voted for Trump's appointments, cabinet appointments, in almost every case, with some exceptions. So while he was anti-Trumpian, I don't think he would ever have considered leaving the Republican Party because he was essentially and fundamentally a Republican in the classic sense.
Yeah, but you're right, entirely right. But he was a moderate Republican, and he was the vote that stopped that awful health care bill from passing in the U.S. Senate. And he's an example of the type of Republican that is now becoming extinct. As more and more moderates choose to just leave and retire, there are not going to be any more John McCain's or Slade Gorton's or Gordon Smith's from Oregon. The type of Dan Evans, Slade Gorton, John McCain type Republican is becoming extinct.
McCain opposed the torture tactics under Bush Cheney. but advocated for the liberal use of drones under the Obama presidency. Some people really fault him for choosing Sarah Palin and calling her the founding hockey mom of the Tea Party. Mm-hmm. That's debatable. There was the campaign town hall in 2008 where a woman said she couldn't trust Barack Obama because he's an Arab, and he, in a sense, I mean, he said, no, ma'am, he's a decent family man. He's a citizen, although he didn't say, well, what's your problem with Arabs in the first place?
He said, no, he's a decent family man in response to that question,
yeah,
which is not an appropriate response to that question.
Right. But it's a whole lot better than the rest of the Republican Party's doing with that type of racist insanity that's happening out there.
Well, that shows how the curve has shifted.
I understand.
So as you mentioned, less than 24 hours after McCain's death was announced, Seattle City Councilor Shama Sawant tweeted, quote, "A politician's legacy is a political, not personal question. An enthusiastic supporter of every imperialist war while in office, John McCain shares responsibility for hundreds of thousands of deaths. To whitewash that is to disrespect those who died in Iraq, Afghanistan, elsewhere, not to mention the countless working people's lives damaged by McCain's support as a senator for brutal neoliberal social and economic policies in the United States. Our solidarity belongs with the millions of families suffering under such policies here and abroad." Chris, how did you react to Sawant's remarks?
I retweeted it and had some remarks of my own. Basic courtesy. You don't speak ill of the dead. You at least give the man the courtesy of, if you disagreed with him, you know, not attacking him before he's in the ground. It's bad manners. It's just wrong. John McCain wasn't a saint. He got a lot of things wrong, and he apologized for a lot of things. But that's just classless.
As a journalist, though, there is a part of me that feels like when you're looking back on the legacy that this very important person left behind, you do need to genuinely examine the good and the bad. I mean, this isn't my grandmother that we're talking about. This is a very, very influential person who's leaving behind a legacy. I don't know if I agree with Shama Sawant in particular, but I do think that we maybe haven't seen some of the critical coverage in media that I would expect when you're sort of taking an honest look at someone's legacy.
I think that the problem with zeroing in on this particular city council member is everything that she says is sort of designed to be attention getting and news causing. And so you have to look at this tweet or this apparently extremely long series of tweets like it's a political speech that she's giving at City Hall. It's very similar. She often gives long discursive speeches that don't have a whole lot to do with the legislation and have a lot to do with promoting her party, her agenda, and often her national agenda. And so when I see it, roll my eyes a little bit and think, okay, well, I would really like to hear you talking about what you're doing for your district or what's happening at City Hall. And so that's the frustration when I see something like that. It's not, oh, this is really rude, because what do you expect from a socialist, you know, person who does not agree with the Democratic Party and considers them neoliberal shills for corporate, you know, fascists or whatever, to say about a Republican. So I wasn't surprised by that. But I also think, you know, is it the best use of a platform of a local city council member to be denouncing a national figure who just died?
Well, she seemed to achieve her aim in that she made national news. And what should be a higher calling for Sawant, saying yet another blandly nice thing about a U.S. senator she probably never met, or taking the chance to call out wars that she opposes?
But this is why compromise and civility and moderation and actually getting things done is passing out of our politics, because everybody uses everything as an opportunity to make the most extreme statement possible to fire up their base. There's an idea about just comity.
Well, she just politically opposed his support of wars where people die. I mean, we agree, or this is separate from whether you agree with her politics.
And I get that, and I understand, well, we don't want traditional politics. Well, you know what? Traditional politics actually used to work. Budgets passed, and you didn't have the kind of insane gridlock you have in Washington, D.C.
Well, Shama Sawant doesn't work in Washington, D.C., and that was kind of my point. I mean, none of the other people, it isn't true that everybody is just saying the most insane thing to get national news. The other eight city city council members. I don't know if they made any statement about McCain's death. If they did, it didn't make it into my inbox, and it didn't make it into the news. So that's not true. This is just sort of par for the course for this particular city council member, and I don't think we should get too bent out of shape about it.
I think she's a spokesperson for a growing movement out there and something that's causing the polarity and the reaction. And that's exactly what it is, reaction. Because now the right reads that stuff and gets even harder in their opposition.
Yeah, I've read that denunciation from the right.
What I struggle with is, like, at what point, like, what's the waiting period? Because at some point I do want a critical look at Senator McCain's legacy, the good and the bad. So, you know, I'm just not sure, you know, when someone dies, you want to show respects. But then at what point are you allowed to say, here's where I genuinely really thought he was, you know, in Shama Sawant's case, she is allowed to say, I think he was not a very good senator. Clearly she believes that.
You know, in the old days, there was that. It was until the funeral. That was don't do that. Until, and again, the old rules and the old norms of how we treat each other in politics are passing away. And
wait,
it's not good.
Would you be okay with it if she said it the day after the funeral or his casket was lowered into the ground?
I would be a lot less opposed to it. He had literally just died within hours. It's grotesque.
We are going to shorten that window of when you get to criticize someone when we overcome our fear of our mortality. So I'll let you know. We'll be reporting live when that happens here on KUOW. Again, McCain's funeral service tomorrow morning. National Cathedral starts at 7 a.m. Seattle time. Former Presidents Obama and Bush will give eulogies, and the whole thing will be live streamed on many media website, and you'll hear excerpts of the service here tomorrow morning and after that on KUOW. We'll be right back at the Week in Review in just a moment. We're live tweeting the Week in Review at KUOW, so please join the discussion there. I'm talking with Erica C. Barnett, David Croman, and Chris Vance, and there's no deal yet for Seattle teachers and staffers negotiating a contract with the school district. The union says it'll strike if there's no deal by Wednesday, the first day of school. Some of the educators have been picketing outside school buildings. Union rep Jesse Hagopian says this is about pay, it's about limiting caseloads for counselors, it's about racial justice initiatives, it's about health care for teachers.
Substitutes in our city don't receive health care unless they work 60 days in the same position. So they might work 59 days in one classroom and then switch to a classroom across the hallway, and they're no longer eligible for health care. That's just wrong.
So Seattle parents sit and wait. Over in Kent, teachers reached a contract just in time to start school yesterday, and this is playing out here and there in districts all across the region. Chris Vance, our state legislature is finally in compliance with a court order to fully fund education. So why are so many educators threatening to strike?
This is so frustrating. I was a member of the House Education Committee for 8 years. I worked for Randy Dorn at the Superintendent of Public Instruction. I was sort of right in the middle of a lot of this McCleary stuff. The court, I think, and everybody else has lost track of what McCleary was supposed to be all about. Article 9, Section 2 of our Constitution, in unique language that no other state has, says that it is the paramount duty of the state of Washington to amply fund a uniform system of public education. We have way too much local control. There shouldn't be levies at all. There shouldn't be local bargaining at all. The state should fund our schools fully and control them. And instead, the legislature did the worst of all things, which is they gave the school districts a bunch of new money, and school and teacher salaries have gone up dramatically. But they did not take away their ability to bargain for the levies. But then they said, we're going to lower the levies in 2 years, which causes this angst over whether that anything is sustainable. The legislature's McCleary fix has just thrown gasoline on this whole fire about districts whipsawing each other. You know, teachers' unions say, this district gave me this, and so we're right next door, you've got to give me that. Until we actually comply with the Constitution and fund and govern our schools from Olympia and rather from local school boards, you're going to continue to have this sort of labor unrest.
Did you say Seattle teachers' pay went up dramatically?
Teachers' pay everywhere has gone up dramatically. In Auburn, where I live, the median teacher salary in 2011 was $72,000. Now it's $93,000. The legislature has put billions more dollars into public education, which is good. But they didn't restrict local bargaining over levies. And so the unions are continuing to do what they do, which is threaten strikes for ever more dollars.
Are you suggesting, Chris, that that the salary should be uniform across
yes.
the state?
Yes, absolutely.
Regardless of local conditions?
Yeah, no, you can have a local inflation factor, but the salaries across the state used to be set by the state. And it's only recently that we've gotten away from that.
But in Seattle, the starting teacher salary is around $50,000.
Which is triple what it used to be.
Well, yes, and as is the home value mm-hmm. of a house in Seattle. I think the average rent is over $2,000 now. You mm-hmm. can't, I mean, if you make $50,000, you are considered low income in the city of Seattle, and you might not be in another part of the state. In fact, you probably wouldn't be in many parts of the state. And so I think to suggest that that is a reasonable starting salary for, just for example, let's throw up $50,000 for everywhere, it doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense to me.
No,
Seattle
and,
is a really...
The first thing you asked me is should everybody be paid the same across the state? No, there should be factors for cost of living in local areas, but it should be set by the state and not subject to local bargaining. I'm old enough here to remember that's the way it used to be. That's how the legislature responded to the Duran decision back in 1977, and that's what they should have done with McCleary. Instead, they have now continued local bargaining and then shrink the pot of the levies to even more increase the angst.
It seems like I've heard you on here before, though, saying that the legislature never gets anything done, which I think is absolutely true. Mm-hmm. So to say that this wonderful body, the legislature, should have the authority, you know, I don't know, every year, every few years, whenever, to set a uniform set of standards and have, you know, inflation for local conditions and what other factors.
They do it for every other state employee. Every other state employee, the legislature sets the salaries. It's only teachers who are allowed to bargain locally, and that's what's creating this insanity.
What do you think we'll get now that the state had to comply with this order, a court order, to fund education? Do you think we're going to get back to a statewide setting of teacher salaries?
No, because the WEA is adamantly opposed to that. The education establishment is adamantly opposed to that. Superintendents and others like local bargaining as much as they hate strikes, because they like to have the ability to have some control over their budgets. The education community loves local control, but local control is creating this chaos. And by the way, the words local control aren't in the Constitution. What is in the Constitution is uniformity, but nobody wants to go there.
Do you think school districts value their teachers and staff less than the public does?
I think that the public, broadly considered, if you look at public salaries, I think the public would be and is angry at the notion that teachers in Seattle are making what are fundamentally low-income wages, where you would qualify for all types of housing programs, where teachers are having to take second shift gigs to make enough money to afford to stay even close to the city, and where a lot of teachers have really long commutes from where they live to the school district where they work. And, you know, the other problem is that there really is a threat of a drain to these other districts that are very, very close to Seattle and where some of these teachers live closer to anyway, like Bellevue, where teacher pay is higher. And so regardless of whether we think it should be state control or local control, it is local control. And so looking at that situation, does it make sense for teachers for any teacher to be in Seattle and be impoverished, essentially, by, you know, the standards of how much it costs to live here? I don't think so.
And I'm not an education reporter, so I'm haven't.
And nor am I. This is just my opinion as a reader of other
right.
smarter education reporters.
Yeah, exactly. But it strikes me as an odd situation where you have a school like Tacoma, which has huge levels of low income students, getting less money out of this in the long run than a school district like Lake Washington, which has, you know, something only like 10% low income. You know, again, being more of an outsider than a reporter on this, I read a statistic like that and I'm surprised.
Anyone predicting a strike or a contract agreement?
I have no idea.
Parents want to know.
I have no idea.
Parents are, I mean, I'm hearing from parents who are frustrated about getting information from the district. I don't know how much information the district has to give them, but, you know, I'm going to send my kid to the YMCA or to the Pacific Science Center or whatnot.
I have no idea if Seattle particularly is going to strike, but there's so many school districts right now that are on the verge of striking. I could probably make a pretty confident prediction. We're going to have an unprecedented number of teacher strikes next week, all across the state.
We'll watch it together on KUOW Seattle, where this is the Week in Review. We're running down the top stories of the week with Erica C. Barnett from the CisForCrank.com and David Croman, reporter at Crosscut. Chris Vance has been a state Republican Party chair and a county council member and a state legislator. And now, what do I call you now?
Co-chair of Washington Independence, working on creating a moderate centrist third party.
A third party, moderate and centrist. We're going to come right. We're just about at the center of the Week in Review. We'll be right back. We're live tweeting the Week in Review at KOW. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle City Light finally has a new leader. This has been the city's highest paying job with almost $1.5 billion budget, but there have been big problems at City Light. And David Croman, one of those problems seems to be that we're using less electricity.
Yeah, there are a lot of different problems from top to bottom, the most existential being the City Light's efforts to get people to be more energy efficient have worked too well. So they're basically just not making as much money as they used to. Plus, City Light has made a lot of its money by reselling kind of excess energy that they get from the hydro dams. That market has plummeted also. So they're taking in a significantly less amount of money every year, which leaves you with two options. You either raise the rates on utility payers or you cut. They're going to be doing both or some combination of the two.
Yeah, plus you've got cost overruns and wrong bills, customers getting bills based on estimates for how much electricity they'll use, not their actual use.
Yeah, so they bought this new billing system, which came in at $43 million over budget. And then when they implemented it, this system was kind of set up to do all this automated stuff to like give you your bill faster or whatever. But what was really happening is it was rejecting actual input from meter readers in favor of these estimates that were actually like way higher than what a lot of people actually needed to be paying. I could spend this whole show just talking about the issues at Seattle City Light.
But what about the smart meters? What about the smart meters? Those are going to be great, right?
Well, so those smart meters were supposed to come in tandem at the same time with this billing system. So the two would work together and it would be this happy thing. Billing system comes in $43 million late. Smart meters, first they sort of cut back the program quietly without telling anybody. And then those are now $17.5 million over budget and late.
And some people are suspicious of the smart meters anyway.
Yeah, I mean, people are sort of concerned about privacy issues. I don't know how seriously to take those or not. But. And then on top of that, there are complaints of sexism in the department. They've settled with several of their employees, so there's a big HR issue for this new woman to take on. It's in some ways not a very enviable position, but on the other hand. She can kind of come in and make things better. I mean, she's coming in at a not very good place in Seattle City Light.
Yes. We've given you the backdrop, by the way. Now, this new leader, the City Light leader, Deborah Smith is her name, and she comes from, I assume, another major American metropolis, right?
When, in fact, she comes from Newport, Oregon.
Which I had to look up. Is on the coast. I wasn't sure.
It's Newport, on the coast.
Newport's beautiful.
Yeah, but I've never been.
On the coast, it has a $100 million annual budget compared to City Light's $1.4 billion annual budget. Yeah. It has about 140 employees compared to City Light's 2,000. So it's a significant increase. She did work in Eugene before that, which is a little bit closer. It's a huge job. When I talked to one of the board members in Newport about her, I've never actually heard anybody say such positive things about somebody coming in. He used the word exceptional about 20 times in our interview. So, I don't know how seriously to take concerns that she's not going to be able to upscale to this larger utility, but there's a lot to go through there, and I think it's going to take her a while.
Yeah, I think what I was struck by, and I haven't covered this story basically at all, but I have read your coverage, David, and the Times coverage. What I was struck by, though, was the similarity in a way between Deborah Smith and Jenny Durkin in their previous experience. Durkin said when she was campaigning that she would be able to scale up her experience managing, you know, a couple dozen people, a few dozen people in the U.S. Attorney's Office to managing more than 10,000 people at the city. And I think she's really struggled in a lot of ways with the enormity of that task, getting department directors appointed and just kind of filling positions and things like that. So there's sort of a parallel situation that's possible here where you have another administrator coming in who's only worked at a much smaller, I mean, even Eugene is quite a bit smaller, utility coming in and trying to manage. How many employees are there? You said 2,000?
Almost 2,000.
Yeah. I mean,
people might not know that the city deals with hydroelectric dams across the state. Mm-hmm. It's quite big.
Across yeah, and the scalability.
Yeah, across the region.
The scalability issues aren't just like managing the same, you know, the same type of employees and tasks as they are in Newport, Oregon. I mean, as you mentioned, it's all over the state. It's all over the region. And it's a bigger job than just scaling up the exact same job, you know, times 15 or whatever it is.
Right. But she comes in, you know, I think in past they've had kind of people with engineering or line work experience head City Light. She comes in sort of more from the customer service, human resources, strategic planning side. So when you look at when you actually look at her resume, it makes some amount of sense considering the issues in City Light. That is the biggest question, though, is just whether it makes sense to go from such a small utility to such a large utility.
Jenny Durkin has inherited a mess. Seattle's got problems everywhere you look. And it's for her politically, it's a great opportunity. No one's blaming her yet for any of these problems. She has a chance to fix it and clean it up and make Seattle work again and to be viewed as a great mayor. It's kind of I think it's fun to come in when your predecessors screwed everything up and you get to be the cleanup crew. But she has to perform. She's got to make things better.
What's fun about it?
Well, it's not, you can just in front of your board or whatever and say, it's not my fault. I'm trying to fix it. I'm the guy trying to fix it.
Okay.
I think actually for the first 6 months of her term, she'd really kind of held off on doing that very often, which sort of surprised me. But in recent months, we've been hearing her say basically that more often.
Well,
serve as a segue to our next topic.
Yeah. Yes. And speaking of blaming previous administrations for things.
Yes.
Back to you, Bill.
Yeah, back to you. Well, we're going to talk in a few minutes, right? About what's going on at the city regarding its transportation bugandagalalia. But first, to wrap up, the new utility leader. Do you think Deborah Smith is going to make $340,000 like the last
that
one?
That was my next question. Right. I'm so curious about this.
Yeah.
That was I think probably it will be something close. I mean, I don't know. She'll get a lot of opposition to that from Councilmember Sawant, who really hates these large contracts. Mm-hmm. The argument in favor of such huge contracts is that the city is really competing with the private side, the private sector. One thing that she probably won't get anymore for a while, City Light, the head of City Light was the only department head who was eligible for a bonus on top of already being the highest paid employee in the city of Seattle. It appears that the city council is not willing to do that anymore. So she'll lose her opportunity for a bonus, but I think it's safe to say she will make north of $300,000.
Well, what I find interesting about that situation is I think the city council may have something to say about paying a woman less than the previous.
Right.
Because there was actually a precedent for this at Seattle Public Utilities where the new director, the new under Murray, so current director, was paid significantly less than her predecessor. Mm-hmm. And that was because she bargained for less, according to the HR department. But I think that this could become an issue. This is pure speculation based on precedent, but I think that'll be an interesting discussion.
That's interesting. I mean, but there's that. I hadn't actually thought of that. That's super interesting. But the last guy that they brought in, he came from Austin department. So that's a much larger department. So I don't know if her sort of going to the smaller utility has anything to do with that. I'm not sure. It'd be interesting to see.
Okay. By the way, whatever happened to Larry Weiss?
I don't know. Sort of rode off.
He gave himself perfect marks on his performance evaluation I read in your coverage.
Yeah.
Which led apparently the city to just get rid of that option completely during the budget talks.
Out of 30, I think it was 35 categories, he gave himself 5 out of 5 on all 35. I've never... Nope, you got to give yourself at least 1-4.
Have you ever? I mean, I can't even.
You gotta ding yourself for something. You have to look and find the thing to.
I feel like I did this wrong my whole life working for people. I'm always so modest. I'm like, I don't know, 3.5. Do I deserve a 4?
Right.
and this is why men get ahead.
And it's one thing if City Light was going great, but we now know that it was not going very well.
Yes, as it turns out. Okay. We're on the Week in Review. We're going to get to some streetcar news. I desire to get to that topic in just a moment. We're going to first hit the big, expensive back-and-forth roof. Just a sec. Okay, we have a KUOW reporter at City Hall to talk about. We were just talking about some of the struggles that Mayor Durkan and the city of Seattle have been facing. One of them, of course, has been the unbuilt streetcar. We have these two streetcar lines that don't go together, and we've had cost overruns in that department. And KUOW reporter Carolyn Adolf is with us live. Carolyn, hello. What's new?
Well, just about everything, Bill. The Seattle Streetcar Connector Project is going to be even more expensive than we thought we already knew.
The city's just saying that today?
Yes. They have a host of rather poor options in front of them from a cost perspective, but they're saying that the penultimate worst-case scenario is that instead of costing $140-some million as originally projected, will cost something like $250 million. But that, Bill, is before they deal with the engineering problems due to the streetcars that are being ordered being heavier and longer than the rest of the items on the system, so that there's going to be, there are still a lot of risks that remain unknown. And Bill, what this boils down to is that we can't expect a decision on the streetcar soon, because as they start to try to pull these things apart and understand them better, there could be all kinds of implications for federal funding. And the feds are going to want to look in on this matter. They've promised $75 million on this project, and they have the option to take some or all of that away if they don't like what the city ends up deciding to do with the streetcar connector project.
Okay, so the middle streetcar line that goes from, or that doesn't go from Pioneer Square to
Westlake.
We don't know, what we know is if it gets built, it'll cost another $60 million or so more than we thought, and we don't know whether it's going to get built at all. Carolyn Adolf reporting live from Seattle City Hall. Carolyn, thanks a lot for that.
Thank you, Bill.
So, surprised that the cost overrun has a cost overrun on the Seattle streetcar?
I'm not terribly surprised. We've been anticipating this report for quite some time now, and it didn't look good from what I heard, you know, about it, the scuttlebutt about the report before it came out. This is another $55 million. And, you know, if I was a betting woman, I would say that this is pretty bad for the streetcar. I don't know if I'm really even going out on a limb there. But the other option that the city has is obviously to kill it, which would cost, I think, $55 million total. So it's going to cost money no matter what. The $55 million includes a lot of stuff like utilities, as well as money that they've already spent on the actual cars themselves. The overruns come from things like accelerated construction costs, the fact that labor costs more, the fact that they're going to potentially have to redesign elements of the streetcar line and the maintenance facility to accommodate these 10-foot longer new cars that they bought. So it's a lot. The one sort of bright spot, I guess, in this report is that it's not going to cost as much to operate as they had thought and it had been reported. So the operating costs are going to be about $16-something million a year, according to this report, which is around what SDOT originally estimated.
And if you're a fan of streetcars as an idea, then the report in some ways looks okay, too, because their projected ridership is like 6 million people, which would blow. I think without building this, they're projecting that the two disparate lines would get about 1.5 million people per year.
But should we believe their numbers on either operating costs or ridership?
I mean, if you're gonna believe anyone ever, then
yeah, you have to
take somebody's word for it. I mean, obviously, this is an outside consultant. This isn't the city saying this. So in theory, they don't have any motivation to juice the numbers in any particular way. Their ridership projections, if they do complete this, are super rosy. It's just they're in addition to this $250 million price tag, there are more uncertainties. So they didn't rule out that this could get more expensive. They might have to renegotiate some contracts with the contractors because of this delay. I mean, there's a lot of complications beyond just the cost. Is the juice worth it?
Our region has done a lot of things right over the decades, but one of our greatest failings is over and over again walking away from rail projects. And that's why we don't have the type of mass transit system that just about every other big city has, and one of the reasons why our traffic is such a ridiculous mess. I hope that Mayor Durkan this is ugly, but she has the political capital because, again, she inherited this mess. She didn't create it, to push forward and finish it. It will be expensive, I'm sure. But, you know, we have done over and over again, we've walked away from these sort of projects. This region needs more alternatives to driving. And we should have finished, you know, when they were talking about expanding the monorail, that should have happened. When we never should have turned down light rail in the 1970s. Anything to get more people.
You don't hesitate to put light rail in the same bucket as the monorail or the streetcar.
The streetcar is a 15-block system.
I get it, but it's the same kind of thing. Is if you can get around, I work in downtown Seattle, and if you can get around downtown without driving, I had to drive here today from my office in downtown Seattle. I guess I could have ridden a bus, but...
Lime bike.
Anything, yeah, okay. That's a long ride.
They're all electric now.
One of the things I admire about Dow Constantine is he is just determined. He was absolutely determined, come hell or high water, that Sound Transit 3 was going to happen. And he took a big hit for that, and there were cost overruns, and there's always cost overruns, whatever. 100 years from now, we need these projects, and I hope she moves forward and finishes this.
The $75 million. Go ahead.
Before you continue, Erica C., I just want to note that Chris Vance has truly left the Republican Party when he says, quote, there's always cost overruns, whatever,
end quote. It happens. Every time government builds something big, it happens.
That's totally true. I will
especially now in King County.
Yeah, because construction costs are high for everything. Everything's going to get cost escalated. So is Sound Transit's light rail. But I think it's important to note that $75 million is not actually in hand. They have not signed an agreement for it. And the Trump administration is withholding funds for transit projects that already have signed agreements, like light rail to Linwood. So I would be very hesitant about assuming that money is going to come in. And that's another huge chunk of the project. I mean, at what point do we stop saying cost overruns, whatever? I mean, it started out at 160 or so. Now it's up to 252. If it's up another 75, is that okay?
But what about the sunk cost of having two streetcar lines that don't meet?
Well, you just named a well-known fallacy, the sunk cost fallacy.
That's true. I did combine those. You're right. It's sunk cost, but for the amount of bucks... The middle line, cynics have even said that's why they planned it that way. You do the one on the left, the one on the right. So then people feel like, well, we got to do the one in the middle to hook them up.
God, that gives the city of Seattle so much credit.
But wouldn't the planning that took. but wouldn't the streetcar line make much more sense if it went all the way through?
I mean, if you're looking at it on a map, sure. And it would definitely be faster through downtown because it'll be grade separated. On the other hand, has anyone ever considered going to, let's say if you're in Pioneer Square, getting to South Lake Union, let's say you're in your car or on a bus, whatever, by going all the way through downtown, all the way through Belltown, or getting to Capitol Hill
that way.
Those
are called tourists.
Right, so you're going to take Pioneer Square all the way through downtown, all the way through Belltown, all the way through South Lake Union, all the way up to First Hill. And I mean, that just seems fantastical to
tourists
me.
Tourists got nothing but time. They're on vacation.
But you don't get those ridership numbers with just tourists. Yeah, that's the problem.
True. And there are businesses, for example, in the International District who are saying, we were promised that you were going to ship in those people on the streetcar from the Space Needle or from, you know, Pike Place Market.
The worst enemy of this new line are the two existing lines because they've been kind of, by all accounts, underwhelming. So now, I mean, you asked if we should believe those ridership projections. And that's kind of the problem, that we're in this position where people are saying, well, if we complete this final line, the other two will benefit a lot, which might be the case, but we're sort of taking that on faith because the two existing lines are chronically underperforming.
And again, this is a problem being old. I remember like when the Sounder train started running and they were 2/3 empty and conservative critics, oh, look at that, nobody, look at them now, they're packed. I mean, you build these systems to plan for the future as your population continues to grow. And if it was a good idea to start it, I'm sorry that there's a cost overrun, but you put your head down and you push on through.
I just don't think you can call a loop on the around the central part of Seattle a system that's going to serve commuters, which is what you're comparing it to. No. The monorail, no. Light rail, and Sounder are all commuter systems. And so this is essentially, I mean, as Bill said, it's, you know, they're hoping that tourists will ride it. It's a very slow way of getting from one end of the loop to the other. And, you know, I think that it will have ridership if it's built, which I think is somewhat doubtful now, through downtown. But essentially, then you're just reproducing the functions that used to be served by the ride-free area, where anyone could ride through downtown. I'm old enough to remember that. It actually wasn't that long ago. Mm-hmm. And so...
That was before the Link trains took over the tunnel and all the buses had to come up to the surface streets, which made the traffic downtown even
worse.
Well,
that hasn't happened yet.
Okay, I want to make sure. I'm not going to let this conversation go in a circle. That's why I'm refusing to build the line connecting one end of the conversation to the other. It's a one-way. We're going to continue on the Week in Review. Chris Vance, former state Republican Party chair, current co-chair of Washington Independence.
Right.
And Erica C. Barnett, csforcrank.com. David Croman from Crosscut. We'll all be right back. The Week in Review continues with David Croman, Erica C. Barnett, Chris Vance. I'm Bill Radke. The Seattle Mariners won $180 million public dollars over 25 years to keep up Safeco Field. Opponents say the county should use some or all of that money for affordable housing and let the Mariners pay to keep up their stadium. Well, voters might get some say in that. Last night, a King County councilor proposed putting the question on the ballot next year as an advisory vote. Rod Dembowski is against the public funding plan, so does he assume the public would vote no on that?
I don't know.
It strikes me as he doesn't want to give them that money, clearly.
But he doesn't want to be blamed for the deal falling apart. Either.
Or yeah, he just maybe doesn't have the support on the council.
Yeah, so this is so familiar. Unfortunately, I was the chairman of the county council's budget committee when the final deals were struck on both stadiums, and being sucked back into the vortex of stadium politics is sort of painful. But
I'm sorry.
But I was there when the deals were cut, and here's the thing. The Mariners don't own Safeco Field. We do. They are tenants. We are landlords. They agreed to pay for routine maintenance, basic routine maintenance, cleaning it, that sort of thing. The public was always on the hook for major capital repairs. So the question then is, what revenue source do you use? I think it was always contemplated that you'd use the hotel motel tax, which is under law, 37% of the hotel motel tax must go for low-income housing. 37% must go for the arts. The debate is what to do with the remainder. The Mariners and the executive struck a deal that part of that remainder would go to fix Safeco Field. People are now saying, no, we want all of it for low-income housing. Okay, great. Then what revenue source do you want to use to help fix the roof on Safeco Field?
They want to use the revenue source of the Seattle Mariners' profitability.
So that's like saying that I live in an apartment complex and the roof is leaking. And now, instead of the landlord fixing it, I have to fix it.
You got a good job.
That's sort of how it actually works as someone who lives in an apartment complex.
No.
It
is a public building that serves a public good. And it's not just the Mariners. It's mostly for the Mariners, but it's used for other things. We just had a couple big concerts down there with Pearl Jam to raise money for the homeless. Safeco Field is a public building. It needs to be maintained by the public.
The... Oh. go ahead.
I was going to say, I think two things have happened, though, since that original deal. One, I think the public more generally is just much more skeptical of putting public dollars towards stadiums. And two, the housing crisis has gotten terrible. So regardless of what happened in the 90s, I think what we're seeing is a reaction to a very different climate than when that original deal was signed.
Some people, the loud people, but if this really becomes a crisis, wait and you just see what will happen in terms of the pressure comes from sports fans and baseball fans. They haven't weighed in on this yet, but I lived through that, and you really don't want to cross your baseball team.
It's interesting that they haven't weighed in, though, given that the county council meeting this week had people lined up around the block waiting to testify in favor of spending money on our affordable housing crisis. And I would also note that I wasn't here in the 90s either, but my understanding was that the Mariners agreed to keep it up not to a base minimum, but to the applicable standard, which is actually to keep it in the top third of baseball stadiums.
Major capital repairs.
Okay. You're calling it routine maintenance, and I've looked at the documents, and they say applicable standard, and the applicable to standard is defined in such a way that it's not just basic stuff. But I think David's point is also, you know, important to consider. I mean, we have a crisis. That money can be used for affordable housing. And it is incredibly, I mean, at the very least, it's incredibly unseemly to say we have this housing crisis. Dow Constantine, you know, had at one point proposed doing a tax initiative, a sales tax measure for affordable housing and to pay for part of to address the homelessness crisis. Pulled back on that and is now proposing $180 million for a sports stadium for an extremely profitable franchise that draws millions of people a year. So I think at the very least, you can acknowledge it's a little unseemly when we're in this crisis where people are showing up during the workday, taking time out of their day to beg for funding for affordable housing in the city that needs it so badly.
I don't find it unseemly at all. I think you're forgetting that over a third of the hotel Milto tax will go for affordable housing. People have portrayed this as
I'm not forgetting that.
Public dollars and everything. No, they're already, we're just talking about, all we're really debating is what percentage of the remaining 26% or so of the hotel motel tax should go for the stadium versus affordable housing. And everybody's getting all Twitter-pated here because it's easy.
Twitter-pated.
You know, yeah. It's easy to go after, oh, rich athletes and everything. Fine. I mean, but if the Seattle Mariners don't sign a new lease in Safeco Field, then watch how this debate changes.
Sorry, I'm Googling Twitter-pated. Go on. one of the things, Twitter-pated, there it is, infatuated or obsessed. Gus is still hopelessly Twitter-pated by Lee in a state of nervous excitement. I guess you're going with the second definition.
I think
state
it's something Winnie the Pooh used to say, if I remember correctly.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was Winnie the Pooh Twitter-pated with Rabbit?
I think it was an A.A. Milne kind of reference.
Uh-huh. Okay. I'll accept it. The Mariners say that they need to maintain the Safeco Field's retractable roof, which is an expensive roof, and Councilmember Dave Upthegrove told the Seattle Times, quote, "This is the Mariners looking a gift horse in the mouth. The public built this for them. If the Mariners want to protect their grass, that's their business, and they ought to be paying for it and not get Twitter-pated." I added, the very last part is not technically
that's just wrong. And I was there. Every study that was done showed this stadium is not viable without a retractable roof because fans won't come if they think the game might be rained out. So this was studied to death. The roof is not a luxury. It is essential to making that stadium function. And again, no one ever said that routine maintenance included massive repairs to this huge, complicated structure. If you want to use this source of funding for affordable housing, fine. If I were the Mariners, I'd just say, fine. Tell me what other source of funding you're going to use to fix your stadium.
Okay. Councilmember Rod Dembowski, chair of the committee handling the funding request, has announced this proposal to put the Safeco hotel motel tax funding question on the ballot as an advisory vote, so obviously non-binding. This would be during a February special election.
And I don't think that's going to happen. Here's what I am hearing, though, that this is typical courthouse politics, is there'll be a lot of thunder and noise, and then they'll cut a deal behind the scenes and come up with something that is a little less for the Mariners, but we'll get the votes to pass. If you made me bet money, that's what's going to happen in the next few weeks.
So the Mariners are not going to Oklahoma City?
They're not even close yet.
Okay. Finally, there's a concert at Safeco Field tomorrow night. Foo Fighters is the band led by the former Nirvana drummer, Dave Grohl. I would call him America's most affable approachable rock star, don't you think? The band has released a list of items that you may not bring into Safeco Field tomorrow. They include professional audio or video recording devices, unflattering photos of Ryan Seacrest, weapons, coolers, glass, mixtapes not in CD format, selfie sticks, cans, pirated VHS tapes of Land of the Lost, the series, plastic bottles, cream magazines that do not mention Ted Nugent. Again, do not mention Ted Nugent. Fireworks. It goes on. Alcoholic beverages, beige or mustard-colored macrame wall hangings you cannot bring into the Foo Fighters concert. Leg warmers, no. Backpacks, derogatory press clippings of Shania Twain. Waste packs, any pencil that isn't number two. Homemade nut milks. Scythes, which is probably a good idea. Mm-hmm. And laser pens are not welcome and will not be allowed and will not be tolerated at Safeco Field for the Foo Fighters concert on Saturday.
Maybe we should have the Foo Fighters and Pearl Jam pay for the routine maintenance and the upkeep of Safeco Field. They use it too.
Maybe we shouldn't rely on rich rock groups to have concerts so that we can pay for a tiny sliver of our homelessness crisis. Although that was great that Pearl Jam did that. It's pretty sad that that's the point we're at right now.
This is why we can't have fun things on Labor Day weekend. Because we debate them, but we try to have a good time. With Erica C. Barnett at cisforcrank.com, Crosscut reporter David Croman, Chris Vance, oh, there's the Foo Fighters, former Washington State Republican Party chair and current co-chair of Washington Independence. Thanks for tuning in to The Week in Review. The show is produced by Amina Al-Sadi, and our social media producer, Bon Huberman, was the first person to live tweet this show and is live tweeting her final show because she's going to go on and do more great things. Thank you, Bondo.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The Week in Review. We got a little, what song was that? That was Everlong, I think, from the Foo Fighters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you.
I've never liked
good
the
stuff.
Foo Fighters.
Oh, come
You've
on.
Never liked
oh,
the Foo Fighters?
On.
Oh, we're going to have this offline. That's what they say these days. Thank you, Bon Huberman. Thank you for listening. See you next week.